Hello, everyone. It is a special privilege for me to welcome Bruce Rydell and his wife Elizabeth to the Forum Club and to Naples. I'm also pleased to add my warm welcome to the students of Golden Gate High School and to their counselor, and also to Gloria Katz, a Rydell family member. And not, of course, to forget my own daughter, Stephanie. Bruce is truly cosmopolitan in experience and expertise. He is at the cutting edge of policymaking, not only for his country, but for others across the globe. He represents the very best senior analyst and advisor, on whose knowledge, versatility, and broad view the hinges of national policy turn. Rarely in the news, or on talk shows, or in the public eye, such behind-the-scenes people put in place the building blocks of strategy and diplomatic effort. Bruce's knowledge and focus on Al-Qaeda, jihad, and the struggles of the Middle East are invaluable to our leading decision makers. Bruce grew up in the Middle East. He has studied on both sides of the Atlantic, at Brown and at Harvard, and the Royal College of Defence Studies in London. He has advised four presidents as a member of the White House National Security Staff and on recent policy towards Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iran, and Syria. At the request of David Cameron, he has advised the UK's National Security Council. He has also worked for the Pentagon on defense issues in the Near East and on South Asia, as well as NATO in Brussels. Currently, he is a senior fellow at the Sabin Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institute and teaches at Johns Hopkins School for International Advanced Studies. For the past several months, Mr. Rydell has been advising Bill Gates and his foundation on Pakistan. Mr. Gates is trying to eradicate polio around the world, and Pakistan is the last major country with a polio problem. In his new book, Duty, Robert Gates wrote, "The president reached outside the government to ask Mr. Rydell to lead a 60-day review of the situation in Afghanistan and to recommend changes in the strategy." Mr. Rydell is described as one of the best, most realistic Middle East analysts today. We are indeed fortunate to have such a knowledgeable speaker on this subject. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Mr. Bruce Rydell.
Thank you very much for that lovely introduction, Josephine. Thank you, Bill, for having us here. Thank you, Josephine and Stephanie, for welcoming us to your home last night. And I want to thank the students for being a great warm-up act. I only hope I can do as well in the second half. For 15 years, the United States of America and many of its allies around the world have been at war with what was originally a rather obscure Islamic terrorist organization named Al-Qaeda. The war actually began with a fax. In August of 1998, the Cairo office of an Arabic newspaper, Al-Hayat, received unsolicited a fax addressed to the people of the United States of America, signed by an Egyptian named Ayman Zawahiri. The fax said that a few weeks earlier, the CIA had helped to detain some Al-Qaeda terrorists in Albania. The fax warned that there would be retribution for that operation. The next day, in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, and in Nairobi, Kenya, retribution came. Simultaneously, two truck bombs exploded outside our embassies, and 200 people were killed. In the 15 years since then, we have had some major setbacks in the war against Al-Qaeda. We've also had some major successes. And it's perhaps useful for a minute to review both the setbacks and the successes. On the setback side, of course, was the events of September 11th, 2001, the second bloodiest day in American history. Only one other day in American history saw more Americans die. That was the Battle of Antietam in 1862, when we were killing each other. No foreign enemy has ever inflicted a blow on us as bad as September 11th. Estimates of the cost economically range over $1 trillion. And the impact on our nation's trauma center was traumatic. We had a bit of a nervous breakdown. We've had other setbacks in Bali, in London, in Madrid, across the Arab world, across Iraq, in Mumbai, and just a year ago in Boston. Not all of those were inflicted by Al-Qaeda, the organization, but they all were inflicted by Al-Qaeda, the idea. Al-Qaeda is not just an organization. It is a narrative. It is an ideology. It is the ideology of global jihad, the belief that every American, man, woman, and child, is a legitimate target for terrorism. But we've also had successes, most notably, of course, in May of 2011, when SEAL Team 6 brought justice to high-value target number 1 in Abbottabad, Pakistan. It took us 10 years to find Osama bin Laden, but at the end of the day, you can run, but you cannot hide indefinitely. We've also had successes in the drone war in Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia. Dozens of senior Al-Qaeda officials and operatives involved in planning attacks on America and its allies have been killed in drone strikes. Most notably, Anwar al-Awlaki, an American citizen born in New Mexico of Yemeni origin, who inspired the attack at Fort Hood, Texas, that killed 13 Americans, who was directly involved in the planned attempt to blow up an airliner over Detroit on Christmas Day 2009, and whose writings inspired the attack on Boston last April. Anwar al-Awlaki came up with a nifty little electronic magazine called Inspire, in which you could read articles like How to Make a Bomb in Your Mother's Kitchen, or What to Wear on Jihad. The answer? Warm shoes, exactly as you would expect your mother to tell you what to wear on any kind of trip overseas. We've also had success in foiling plots. Last month, the Israeli Secret Intelligence Service foiled a plot to attack the American embassy in Tel Aviv, Israel. That plot was being orchestrated by the same Ayman Zawahiri who sent us the fax 15 years ago. In 2006, British and American intelligence foiled a plot to simultaneously blow up 7 jet jumbo liners crossing the Atlantic from Heathrow to airports in Canada and the United States. The plot was in its final stages of maturity. 20 terrorists had already been selected. They had done their so-called martyrdom videos explaining what they intended to do. The bombs had been prepared, and we know they would have worked. Imagine if 7 jumbo jets had blown up simultaneously over the North Atlantic. International air travel would have come to an end. Nobody in their right mind would have gotten on an airplane, and those who weren't in their right mind would not be able to get insurance to get on an airplane. Thankfully, we foiled that plot. Where are we today? After 15 years, we are now facing what I have come to call Al-Qaeda 3.0, or the third generation of Al-Qaeda. What do I mean by that? It's an attempt to try to characterize the history of an organization and an idea. Like any attempt to put typology on something, it's not perfect, but it is an attempt to try to make it easier for people to understand what we're dealing with. The first Al-Qaeda was the Al-Qaeda created back in the 1990s in Afghanistan and Pakistan by Osama bin Laden, Ayman Zawahiri, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and a bunch of other terrorists. They're the ones who planned the attack of September 11th, 2001. They're the ones who planned the attack on the American embassies in East Africa. That generation of terrorists, some of them are still around, notably Mr. Zawahiri, but many of them are long gone. They were routed from the battlefields of Afghanistan in 2001 by one of the most brilliant American military and covert operations in history that toppled the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan in less than 100 days. But we failed to get the core al-Qaeda leadership, which crossed over the border into Pakistan and created what I call al-Qaeda 2.0, the group that came roaring back in the 2000s and took advantage of the war in Iraq to build a new al-Qaeda base in that country that cost us 4,000 to suppress and contain. 2011 is, I think, the critical year for the end of that generation and the development of what I call the third generation of al-Qaeda. Two events, unrelated, happened in 2011. First was the SEAL raid that eliminated Osama bin Laden. That SEAL raid broke the appearance, the mythology, of al-Qaeda's invincibility. We proved that no matter how hard you hid, we ultimately would find terrorists who'd committed mass murder in the United States. It also broke the illusion that somehow Osama bin Laden was a modern-day hideout who could never, ever be found by the Central Intelligence Agency. But perhaps the more significant event in 2011 is what people either call the Arab Spring or the Arab Awakening. I don't like the term Arab Spring because it actually happened in the winter. And I'm one of those people who's obsessive about details like that. So I prefer to call it the Arab Awakening. So bear with me as I call it the Arab Awakening. Almost simultaneously, dictators who'd been in office in the Arab world, in Tunisia, in Egypt, in Yemen, in Libya, fell out of office in an incredibly short amount of time. Others became engaged in profound civil wars, like the one we see going on in Syria today. Others were able to hold on to power through the use of outside military assistance. The Arab Awakening initially was a mortal challenge to al-Qaeda, and especially to al-Qaedism. Why? Because the Arab Awakening seemed to show that there was a way to change the Arab and Islamic worlds for the better without violence. Twitter and Facebook toppled Hosni Mubarak, not terrorism. Al-Qaeda's whole ideology was turned on its head. And if you go back and read what al-Qaeda said at the time, they were on the back foot. They didn't know what to say. Ayman Zawahiri gave a 90-minute-long speech in 2011 about the Egyptian Revolution, in which he spent more time arguing that Napoleon Bonaparte was a closet Zionist than trying to figure out why Hosni Mubarak had just been toppled from power. When you're that lost in the past, you've really been caught off guard. But the Arab Awakening didn't have a happy outcome, or it hasn't had a happy outcome yet, and I'll come back to that in a minute. As we all know, it turned from Twitter to violence. Libya as a country broke apart and is today essentially Somalia on the southern shore of the Mediterranean. Yemen, a country that's never really been much of a country at all, has fallen apart even more. Mali, another weak country, an artificial creation of French imperialism, fell apart. And al-Qaeda exploited the opening. And today, the third generation of al-Qaeda is marching aggressively across the Arab world in ways we have never seen al-Qaeda operate before. It is more diffuse, it is more decentralized, but it is as dangerous as ever. In Syria and Iraq and Lebanon, we now have al-Qaeda insurgencies underway that are tearing those countries apart. They didn't start the civil wars, but they've exploited the civil wars. According to the Director of National Intelligence, the al-Qaeda factions in Syria today have over 25,000 men under arms. Israeli intelligence estimate over 40,000 men under arms. These are the largest al-Qaeda armed groups we have ever seen in the history of the organization. And there are multiple. There are two major al-Qaeda groups now operating in Syria. One actually gave birth to the other. The Islamic State of Iraq and al-Shams created Jabhat al-Nusra, or the Victory Front. ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and al-Shams, has now been thrown out of al-Qaeda because it's too violent, too aggressive. When you are so bad that you are thrown out of al-Qaeda, you are the baddest of the bad. And that's what we're dealing with in Iraq and Syria today, and increasingly in Lebanon. Multiple al-Qaeda groups that sometimes collaborate and sometimes literally fight with each other, but all of which are getting stronger and all of which are building safe havens and sanctuaries and tearing apart the borders created 100 years ago in the aftermath of the First World War. The border between Iraq and Syria is an artificial border created by British and French imperialism. Today, it is literally vanishing in front of our eyes. Lebanon's borders, created by French imperialism, today, vanishing in front of our eyes. In North Africa, the same phenomenon. In Algeria, Libya, Mali, Niger, and parts of northern Nigeria. A new al-Qaeda franchise, multiple al-Qaeda franchises competing with each other and taking advantage of soft targets when they can to strike the West, like the attack on the El Amines natural gas facility in Algeria just a year ago that killed over 38 foreign nationals. I've already mentioned Yemen and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, which have been fighting al-Qaeda now for more than a decade, and see an al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula that, while under stress from the drones, is far from defeated. The next al-Qaeda target is increasingly clear. It is Egypt. Egypt, as the largest Arab country, was the greatest threat in 2011. When Egyptians removed a dictator who'd been in office for 30 years and tried to put in place a democratic process, it was the triumph of hope over experience. Egypt had never, ever, ever in its 5,000 years had a democratic government. It had been ruled by pharaohs of one kind or another. But the Egyptian people tried. It didn't work out. A coup came last July. The coup for al-Qaeda and al-Qaeda's sympathizers validated their whole argument. See, we told you all along. It wasn't going to work. In fact, for al-Qaeda, it was even better than that, because the government that replaced Hosni Mubarak was a government led by the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood and al-Qaeda are mortal enemies. They hate each other. Al-Qaeda represents a much more violent alternative kind of Islamism from the Muslim Brotherhood. Ayman Zawahiri, in addition to being a terrorist, a mass murderer, a plotter of numerous plots, is also an author. He's written 30 books. 25 of them are about why the Muslim Brotherhood isn't strong enough and tough enough. I recommend them only if you have a serious problem not being able to go to sleep at night, because they are turgid, and they use analogies that takes years of studying Islamic history to understand. But that's where he stands. The Egyptian coup and the failure of the Egyptian Arab awakening have now made Egypt the next battlefield for al-Qaeda, and we can already see al-Qaeda and al-Qaedism taking root in Egypt, first in the Sinai Peninsula, and now increasingly in the major cities of Cairo, Alexandria, and in the Nile Delta. It is a sad end to an Egyptian experiment. This more diffuse, this more decentralized, this more dangerous al-Qaeda, of course, also is connected to the old al-Qaeda, back in Pakistan, where Ayman Zawahiri is today almost certainly hiding in some hideout that looks an awful lot like the one his boss, Osama bin Laden, was hiding in. That is to say, people in Pakistan, inside the government, will know where he's hiding. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton famously said many times before we found Osama bin Laden in Abbottabad, Pakistan, less than a mile from the front gate of Pakistan's equivalent of West Point, that people in Pakistan must know where he's hiding. Of course she was right. We don't know how high, we don't know how many, but it stretches the bounds of credulity to believe that he was able to hide there for 10 years without anyone in the Pakistani establishment knowing, and Ayman Zawahiri is still doing that today. Al-Qaeda in Pakistan, what the intelligence community refers to as Al-Qaeda Core or Al-Qaeda Central, is in fact really referred to in Al-Qaeda as Al-Qaeda Al-Umm, Mother Al-Qaeda, or the mothership. And that in many ways is the better way to think about it. It doesn't control a global empire, but it's the original ship, it's the original brand, and everyone looks to it for strategic guidance. Al-Qaeda Al-Umm in Pakistan is under pressure. There's no question of that. The policies that we have followed in the last several years, and especially the drones, and especially SEAL number 6's raid, have put pressure on it. But it's not defeated. One thing we have learned about Al-Qaeda in the last 15 years is it has a credible ability to adapt and regenerate itself, Iraq being the most notable example of that. If the pressure on Al-Qaeda Core in Pakistan comes off, especially after American and NATO forces transition in Afghanistan next year, we can expect it to regenerate again. And one thing I think we can be very confident of is that the government of Pakistan, acting on its own, will not be the instrument to prevent that regeneration. We face a long and difficult battle with an enemy which has proven agile and resourceful. Most terrorist organizations don't know how to adapt to the times. Most terrorist organizations get locked in a certain historical paradigm. What is so dangerous about Al-Qaeda is its ability to constantly reinvent itself and adapt to its environment around us. The Arab Awakening is a process that has really only begun, and it, more than anything else, will probably determine the future of Al-Qaeda. I like to remind my fellow Americans that our struggle against British colonialism to create an independent nation and a democratic, effective government began in 1774. And it wasn't until 1792 that George Washington was inaugurated as our first president and this experiment began. If you use the same analogy, it's about 1777 in the Arab Awakening. They got a long way to go. And let's also remember that along our way, a French army and a French fleet came over here to help us out a lot. And I don't see a French army and a French fleet about to help out the Arab world, nor an American army or American fleet. Nor do I think that would make a whole lot of sense. We can do things to protect ourselves, and we should and must do them. We can try to influence the outcome of politics in the Islamic world in a favorable way. At a minimum, we should try to avoid influencing them in the wrong way. We're actually better at doing that than doing it in a positive way. It's hard to do. It's long term. Let me leave you with one final point of perspective, though, before I take your questions. If we look at Al-Qaeda and the threat that it poses to us today, in the perspective of time, I think we see it in a different way. Al-Qaeda, for all the violence that it has propagated, for all the young people who it has turned into suicide bombers, is at the end of the day not Hitler's Germany. It is not about to take over the continent of Europe. It is not Stalin's Russia, armed with intercontinental ballistic missiles to destroy our cities. It's not Nikita Khrushchev's Cuban missile experience. It's not Mao Zedong's Red China. And I would argue it's not even Benito Mussolini's Italy. It is a problem, but it is not an existential threat to our country. We will win this war sooner or later. But patience and perseverance is important. We need to put things in perspective. We need to avoid trying to look for quick fixes or simple silver bullet solutions. We need to remain vigilant. We need to work with allies. We need to recognize that there is a profound experience going on in the Islamic and Arab worlds which does not have a made in America solution to it. We do not need to panic. We do not need to give up our civil liberties. We do not give up human rights in this struggle. In fact, we need to preserve all of those things as we embark upon what will be, without question, the longest war in American history. Thank you very much for your attention, and I look forward to your questions. Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you.
I will present these books on Naples and Marco Island with great appreciation for your speech.
Thank you so much.
I wish the best of luck.
Whoops.
It's wonderful to know that somebody is out there that understands what's going on.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Okay. Sure, we have a good question.
Thank you, Bruce, for such a realistic view of the situation in the Middle East. We have tons of questions. A student question to start with. What was it like to advise presidents on serious and disturbing happenings in the Middle East and South Asia? How open were the various presidents to advice?
Well, you can get a lot of trouble with that question in a hurry. I worked for not only four presidents, but I think six or seven national security advisors. One of them, Sandy Berger, said to me and said to the staff often, if every day that you come to work here, you aren't in a little bit of a sense of awe at what's going on, then you really should stop coming to work here because you've been here far too long. The White House is a special place to work. Presidents are special. Each has their own personality. And if you're at all good at your job, after a while you recognize which buttons of theirs can be pushed to produce the result that you think is the right one. And there are different personalities that way. There are also people who are incredibly busy. They do not have time for a 45-minute lecture. Usually you get 45 seconds, and if you hadn't made your point, it's over. You've lost your time. And you should also be prepared for distractions. Those of you who remember when President Clinton got his dog, I can remember briefing the president while his young puppy dog was eating my notes. I thought that was a little unfair.
How can we defeat Al-Qaeda recruitment? Isn't it crucial that economic opportunity, jobs, etc., be more available in the Middle East and South Asian countries?
Let me start with the big picture, defeating Al-Qaeda more broadly. First thing to bear in mind is Al-Qaeda is not popular in most of the Islamic world. Polling consistently shows that most Muslims recognize Al-Qaeda for what it is, a bunch of murderers who are trying to take a religion and hijack it for their own purposes. That doesn't mean they love us. It just means they've seen through what this organization does. But it's an organization that is not engaged in a popularity contest. As Ayman Zawahiri has said over and again, terrorism is not a popularity contest. It's about terrorizing people, intimidating them. You don't need a lot of people to do that. A very small number of people can do it. How do we dry up the recruitment of al-Qaeda operatives? I think it's many, many things. One of them is, of course, economic opportunity. It's pretty easy in Yemen to recruit people to do bad things. There's no jobs, and there's no prospect of jobs. It's easy in the Pakistani tribal areas to recruit angry people who have no education because there are no schools in the tribal areas. But let's be realistic. The United States cannot refix the Islamic world. We're not going to put a school in every Muslim community. We have our own schools to worry about here at home. So we will have to depend upon the maturation of the Islamic world itself. We need to use the instruments of hard power and soft power in an effective way. What do I mean by that? Hard power. Drones. Commandos. We will have to use those for a long time to come. But we also need to use the instruments of soft power. Economic assistance, promoting peace in the Middle East, trying to encourage a better future. This administration, in my judgment, came in with a pretty good understanding of the need to balance that. And almost inevitably, what we've seen is that the hard power part is on steroids, and the soft power part, over time, seems to wilt away. It's easy. Hard power is always easy to use. You call up the Secretary of Defense, and he will send troops. You call up the Secretary of State, and he or she will get on an airplane and fly around the world trying to persuade people to do the right thing. You can see why you lose balance in these things. We need to do both. We need to do both effectively and smart.
Is Snowden a patriot or a traitor? Are we better off as a result of his leaks? And with that, in the wake of Snowden revelations, what is your assessment of how NSA programs have done against al-Qaeda?
Truth in advertising. I am an advisor to the National Security Agency. My views on Mr. Snowden are pretty black and white. He, like every other American who serves for their intelligence services, takes an oath of office when you come in that you will protect the secrets which you are given charge of. You find endless pieces of paper saying, I understand that if I reveal this, I will go to prison for the rest of my life. You sign a piece of paper that says, when you leave this job, whatever you publish, whether it's a PhD thesis or a recipe for meatloaf, you will send it to us. We will look at it and make sure there isn't a secret meatloaf recipe there that cannot be divulged to the world. Okay, that's an exaggeration. You can write any recipe you want without clearing it. But virtually everything else you have to clear. Mr. Snowden knew this, and he chose recklessly to reveal secrets. He is a thief more than anything else, and he stole from you. He stole from all of you precious things. Now, has that theft encouraged a useful debate about the future of NSA electronic surveillance at home? I'd be the first to admit so. But I wish Mr. Snowden had gone about it in a way that didn't put American intelligence officers at risk overseas, which is what he has done. American intelligence officers will pay for the information Mr. Snowden has put out there. There were other ways to do it. So my answer to the question is he's basically a thief.
What is the role of Saudi Arabia in this situation? Is the Saudi funding jihad still?
Saudi Arabia is America's oldest ally in the Middle East. In 1945, the founder of the modern kingdom of Saudi Arabia and President Franklin Delano Roosevelt met on a cruiser in the Suez Canal and agreed that we would be partners in the future. They also had a discussion of the issue of Palestine and the creation of a Zionist state. Both of them came away with that discussion convinced that they'd persuaded the other of the wisdom of their point of view. FDR thought the Saudis believed that a Jewish state should be created in Palestine, and Ibn Saud was convinced, he convinced the president that a Jewish state should be created in Bavaria, in the heartland of Germany. I use this episode because while we are partners, we often talk past each other, and we really don't share much in common. We don't have any values in common with Saudi Arabia. They are an absolute monarchy. They are an extreme Islamist state, even by the standards of most extreme Islamists. And they don't believe in gender equality or anything like gender equality. And yet we have had a partnership. On the question of Al-Qaeda, after years of pressing and pushing, we have convinced them that Al-Qaeda is their enemy as well as ours. Al-Qaeda, of course, helped by blowing up things in Saudi Arabia and trying to kill members of the royal family. That kind of helped our parking points a lot. Al-Qaeda's last two attempts to attack the United States of America were thwarted by Saudi intelligence. They thwarted them. To give you the best example, Al-Qaeda wanted to put bombs onto commercial delivery airplanes that would bring them to the United States of America. The Saudi intelligence service gave us the tracking numbers of the crates in which the bombs were in. If you cannot foil a terrorist attack with that kind of actionable intelligence, you really ought to get out of the business of counterterrorism. That's as easy as it gets. So our relationship is complex. It's not founded on values, but today we and Saudi Arabia do work together effectively against Al-Qaeda in many places.
What should be our policy toward Pakistan at this point?
Pakistan is the mother of all problems on this issue. I have called it the most dangerous country in the world. It is a country unique in many ways. It is a state sponsor of terrorism. One of the most dangerous terrorist groups in the world today is called Lashkar-e-Taiba, which translates into the Army of the Pure. This is the group that attacked the city of Mumbai in November of 2008 and killed over 166 people, including five Americans, who they deliberately searched out, looking for those people in order to kill. Lashkar-e-Taiba is an instrument of the Pakistani intelligence service. The two are inseparable. Lashkar-e-Taiba and the Pakistani Inter-Services Intelligence Directorate, ISI, are one and the same. We know that because we have been able to capture, indict, and convict the American citizen of Pakistani origin who was behind the attack in Mumbai. And as part of his plea bargaining deal, he has told us how it worked. And at every stage, the ISI and LET worked together. The head of LET today in Pakistan has a $10 million bounty on his head from the United States Department of Justice. But he's not hiding. He's not hiding at all. He appears on Pakistani television once or twice a week. He appears at events sponsored by the Pakistani army. On the other hand, Pakistan is also a victim of terrorism. 40,000 Pakistani civilians have died in terrorist-related violence since September 11th. That's the equivalent of having a dozen September 11ths in one country. We as Americans have the satisfaction of knowing that our presidents, going back to George Bush Sr., told the Pakistanis that if you harbor terrorists, if you patronize terrorism, sooner or later, you will be consumed by it. But being right isn't a solution to the problem. Pakistan, as a country, needs our assistance, but we need to be wide-eyed about it. My view, the time for giving Pakistan military assistance and more military equipment is long since past. We tried that. We attempted to bribe the Pakistani army. It was worth a try. Bribes work a lot, right? Didn't work. At some point when something doesn't work, you ought to stop throwing good money after bad. We should focus more on trying to build Pakistani civil society, build the Pakistani economy. The last data point I want to leave you about Pakistan is a simple one. In April of 2011, when the CIA came to President Obama and said, "We believe we found him. We think he's hiding in this place in Abbottabad. We have a 50% level of confidence he's there," compared to every other report in the past where we said we have a 0.5% level of confidence. That was pretty good. Good enough for government work, as we like to say. But at that point, the United States government under Presidents Bush Jr. and President Obama had given Pakistan $25 billion, $1 billion in military and economic assistance. Why? To fight Al-Qaeda. The president smartly and rightly said, "I'm not sharing this information with the government of Pakistan. I can't trust them." That was the right thing to do. So as we move forward, we need to try to move Pakistan in the right direction, but be wide-eyed about the nature of the government we're dealing with there, and particularly the Pakistani army.
I think in the last comment you covered this, but maybe you're going to have an add-on. How well do you feel President Obama has acted to assure our safety as a nation against the terrorism you have described?
Well, truth in advertising again. I was one of the people who, in the first days of the administration, said we need to use drones more effectively, that drones can be an effective way of attacking our enemies. I have to admit, I think he put the hammer down on the gas a little bit more than I would have. For a couple of years, we were drone addicted. We seemed to think that a drone was the solution to every problem. I think we've got a better balance in our influence between hard power and soft power today. Has the president demonstrated a willingness to go after terrorists around the world? You bet he has. Has he found the solution to Al-Qaeda? Obviously he has not. We are still searching for that.
Will Israel attack Iran?
That's a good question.
Yes,
it is. It's a little bit unrelated. Let me relate it in a minute, though, because I do want to say something about Israel and Al-Qaeda. Israel has always been in Al-Qaeda's trigger, in their target list. It's always been high in their target list, just as high as we are. But until the Arab awakening, Al-Qaeda found no way to get at Israel. Israel's a hard target. It's a very hard target to attack. It basically has one airport. And as any of those of you who've ever traveled through Ben Gurion Airport know, or have gotten on an airplane to go to Ben Gurion, if they don't have the best security in the world, I don't know who does. While maintaining democracy, freedom, and human liberties. The Arab awakening and the chaos that it has produced is now leading to a situation in which Al-Qaeda is surrounding Israel in Syria, in Iraq, in Lebanon, in Egypt. The next vulnerability is Jordan. And we need to do everything we can to prevent Al-Qaeda from getting a stronghold or a safe haven in Jordan. And the people who will tell you that the most are Israeli national security advisors, because that would be a nightmare for Israel. Will Israel attack Iran? Short answer, no, I don't think so, as long as the negotiations process is going on. Israel is not going to attack Iran while the permanent five members of the UN Security Council and Germany are engaged in the negotiations process. That would be the height of recklessness for any Israeli government to do. Do they like the process? Are they confident it will produce the outcome they want? Clearly not. Bibi Netanyahu doesn't keep that a big secret from the world. But for now, I think he's going to keep his powder dry, but his rhetoric will be pretty intense.
I think this will be the last question. What will be Jordan's future? What do you think will happen to King Abdullah of Jordan?
One more, last, truth in advertising. I was born in New York, but I grew up in the Hashemite kingdom of Jordan. So I am a softie for the Hashemites. The Hashemite kingdom of Jordan is an accident of history. Winston Churchill created it in an afternoon in Cairo in 1921. He had too many Arab princes, literally. And he needed one more kingdom because he had one more Arab prince they had to pay off from the First World War. So he looked at Palestine and he divided it on the Jordan River and gave Transjordan to the Hashemites. It's an accident of history. It makes no sense. Its borders are drawn in straight lines, not reflective of the geography or anything. And yet, it has survived. It has survived largely due to remarkable leadership from the first emir of Jordan, Abdullah the First, and then his grandson, King Hussein of Jordan, I think one of the great men of the 20th century, and now the surprising wisdom of Abdullah II. Abdullah II was given the crown prince job as King Hussein was literally dying. An heir had been in the works for 30 years, and at the last minute, the king, and kings are allowed to do this, listened to his wife, who said, "Don't pick your brother, pick our son." That's how we got Abdullah II. So far, it's worked out pretty good, but they need our help. They desperately need our help. Jordan today has over 500,000 Syrian refugees. Trying to take care of them is an enormous burden on the Jordanian economy. That means about 1 in 8 people in Jordan today is a Syrian refugee. Imagine what that would be like in the United States of America. That's why President Obama and King Abdullah, when they met in California a week ago, agreed on a whole new series of economic and military programs to help assist Jordan to try to contain and prevent the spillage of the civil war in Syria over into Jordan. I think it's the right thing to do. But as I said, Jordan's an accident of history. There's no guarantee it will survive.
Thank you very much, Bruce.
Thank you.
Mr. Rydell has left us a lot to go home and think about. Thank you all very much. Have a nice weekend.
I could see. Thank you.